Joining me this morning, we're going to talk about firearms. Freddie Merck's Gunworks. We have Will Parker with us. Good morning, Will. I'm really concerned here, and this is why we've asked this guy to come in and talk with us. With the events in Minneapolis, a man was tackled down, and you can look at this any way you want to look at it, but the fact of the matter is many people criticized him for carrying a weapon when he was encountered ICE officers. And I just want to really straighten all this out and just talk about what about here? What about here in Montana, how things are? So we're going to divide this up into three things. First, we're going to talk about your rights under the Second Amendment. Then we'll kind of talk about your responsibilities as someone who's chosen to carry a firearm. And finally, what do you do if you encounter a law enforcement officer? So, Will, you've been teaching people these things now for better than a decade.
I have, and it's a really good time. And my education in this has taken a hockey stick on that scale in learning.
Yeah. What first of all, what is your background in all this?
Well, like most of us, I did grow up around firearms, and then I joined the military, where I served for more than 25 years in the Navy and Marine Corps. I retired, came home, and started. I worked for a firearms manufacturer for a couple of years, and then I became a full-time trainer, and that's what I do now.
And in your classes, you not only teach people how to fire weapons, particularly handguns, but you also teach the rights and the responsibilities.
I do, and including legal use of force, which is tremendous.
All right, we'll get into that here. Let's start out by let's make sure we understand what our rights are under the Second Amendment.
Well, the Second Amendment. Well, let's just share the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And we think of that, people that think like me, or I think like them, we think that that's pretty cut and dry. That's the end of the laws for firearms, but it's not, because in 1934, the National Firearms Act was enacted. Similar to the National Firearms Act of today, the original act imposed a tax making transfers of firearms defined by the act. And then there's a lot more, but it's mainly regarding shotguns and rifles having barrels of 18 inches or less. It incorporated machine guns and suppressors as well.
Okay. So that goes back to, the time when we were dealing with liquor and all that stuff going on. And
Organized crime
got a big start back then. So that's why they felt like we had to say, do something about automatic weapons.
Yep, they did. And later in 1968, Title II amended the National Firearms Act to cure the constitutional flaw pointed out in a Supreme Court decision called Haynes, which in short order, it was Haynes was a prohibited person. He owned a machine gun. And if he reported it and registered it, it would be a violation of his Fifth Amendment right. So that was the Haynes decision. And then later we got the Gun Control Act of 1968, which required firearms licensed dealers to do business. It identified prohibited persons such as convicted felons, fugitives from justice, unlawful users of controlled substances, those adjudicated mentally defective, illegal aliens, and those dishonorably discharged were prohibited from owning firearms, and it also banned interstate sales of handguns. And then it also dealt with folks who were younger people. It incorporated mm-hmm. that as well.
One of the things that we've talked about before with B.J. Lupton out at Snappy Sports Center is the regulations on firearms dealers. You guys really, you got to toe the line.
We do, and we get inspected as well. And they look through all of our records from the last time they looked through our records. And there's minor thing. There can be minor things. And depending on where your business is located, even those minor things can shut your business down. Whereas in other places, it may not. And it depends on the inspector that you get as well. which, and you never know what you're going to get. It's like a box of chocolates.
Okay. So that's kind of where we stand on our rights. Who cannot carry a firearm under the Second Amendment?
Well, under the Second Amendment, it doesn't specifically state. It goes back in time to what was happening at the time that the Constitution was ratified. That's what, or I should say the Bill of Rights, because that was the Second Amendment. It goes back to that time. What was the norm back then? And that's what the Supreme Court is supposed to rule upon, is what was the practice back then, not what we did in 1950 or, you know, in 1985 or whatever it is.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the Supremacy Clause. Does the federal laws supersede state laws?
Federally, yes. That's the 14th Amendment. And that changed everything in our country when the 14th Amendment was ratified. Okay, so, that was a big deal. So, and it still is today.
We cannot do anything as a state that violates the 14th Amendment.
My understanding is if it's a federal thing, if it's it's a federal issue, or if it's a state issue, because the 10th Amendment in the Constitution, or of the 10 amendments, stated that any power, authority not granted to the federal government remained with the states. Okay. And that's a can of worms I don't know if we want to get into.
Let's not. Who's Freddie Merck?
I am actually Freddie Merck. It was my call sign in the Marine Corps.
Oh, okay. So that explains that. That's why we don't call it Will Parker's Gunworks. Okay. We have to have responsibilities with every right that we have. So talk with us about what are our responsibilities.
Well, understanding and comprehending the legal use of force is absolutely mandatory if you don't want to spend much, if not the remainder of your life in prison. For clarity, I use the phrase legal use of force instead of law of self-defense. That belongs to my friend and mentor, Andrew Branca, which I encourage people to look him up and follow him and learn from him. So without further ado, there are up to five elements of the legal use of force. They are innocence, imminence, proportionality, avoidance, and reasonableness. When all these required elements are there, you have a justifiable use of deadly defensive force. So I'd like to explain what these actually mean.
Yeah.
So innocence, the initial aggressor loses their innocence. The initial aggressor is the first person to threaten or to use force against another. So in general, the element of innocence is defined in an exclusionary manner. That is, the law does not attempt to define what qualifies as innocence, but rather what qualifies as not innocence from the justification of legal use of force. Then we have imminence. This is defined by what Masoud Ayoub calls the AOJ triad. And we should think of it like a window that opens and closes. When the window is open, you can use deadly defensive force. When the window is closed, you just committed a crime. So AOJ, ability. Your assailant possesses the power to kill or to inflict crippling injury. Opportunity, readily capable of employing that lethal power, the ability, here and now. And finally, jeopardy, words and or actions in which a reasonable and prudent person would construe as representing an intent to kill or cripple. Proportionality is the level of force. So think of it as two buckets. There's two categories of force, non-deadly force and deadly force. And our attacker's force that we can use is based on what our defensive force is based on our attacker's force. So we should think of it as a way of considering, do I use deadly force or non-deadly force? Should I use a firearm or can I get away with something like, let's say, pepper spray? And if you're not carrying pepper spray, my question is, why not? Avoidance. We have a legal duty to retreat rather than fight. And avoidance is the one that's most commonly waived by law. So stand your ground laws only relieve you of an otherwise duty to retreat. So in these states, the elements of avoidance may be removed, but that doesn't mean what people think it always means. If you have a safe avenue of retreat and you don't take it, my question is, how reasonable is that? Which brings us to our final element of reasonableness. Reasonableness can be thought of an umbrella that stands over all the other elements. All your perceptions, decisions, and actions that you do in self-defense must be the perceptions, decisions, and actions of a reasonable person. And if you're not a reasonable person, you lose the element of reasonableness and you lose your legal claim of self-defense. And there are two types of reasonableness. They're subjective. This is your genuine good faith belief to act in the way that you do, you need to. And an objective asks that hypothetical, reasonable, prudent person, would they have shared the same subjective belief?
Okay.
And John, I think you wanted to know a little bit about Castle Doctrine.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
really quick. You generally don't have a legal duty to retreat when you are in your dwelling and sometimes your curtilage, which we can't get into, that's another can of worms. So it's really important in duty to retreat states. So, and this comes in many different flavors. So the physical scope, by whom, against whom, and that would be like the people that live in the home that you wouldn't be able to do it against.
Yeah.
That in a quick nutshell, that's the legal use of force.
Okay. Let's talk about the castle. All right. Now, we had a guy down in Missoula who apparently a couple of college students were sneaking into his garage and stealing some of his marijuana. And he decided he needed to stop that. And so basically he shot and killed both of them.
Ironically, you're talking about karma?
Yes.
Ironically, his name's Karma.
Yeah.
He has some bad karma out of that.
Boy, he did. But what was the mistake he made?
He planned it. So it was an intentional homicide.
Okay.
He planned that to happen. He shared with people what he was going to do. He video recorded it. He planned that whole thing instead of just, you know, video recording it and letting the guy go, maybe opening the door. I'm not encouraging people to open the door, by the way.
Yeah.
Don't. And just called the police and then turned in his video so that the young man could have been arrested and dealt with legally. Instead, he took that young man's life.
And I also understand that these guys were not necessarily in his garage at the time. They were on his driveway.
That I don't know off the top of my head.
That was about 10, 12 years
ago. Yeah, it was a long time ago. So I don't remember the details. So if they were in his driveway, that could be considered curtilage. And that's a legal gray area that I'd rather people not do.
Okay. But essentially what we're dealing with here is if somebody is inside your home or inside, you know, where you are, and there's no way for you to get out, obviously, because you're cornered in your own home, you are entitled to use deadly force.
You are. And we call that an occupied structure, meaning a human being is in there, not our pets, an occupied mm-hmm. structure for humans. And the number one thing I can tell people to do is lock your door. Because if someone performs forced unlawful entry to get into your home, meaning they broke something to get in, that changes the whole legal dynamic on your part, better for you, if they break something to get in versus mm-hmm. you left your door unlocked and they just walked in and they're drunk or they got the wrong house. You know, many houses look the same. They're tired. It's happened. Amber Geiger in Texas, she was a law enforcement officer. She went to prison for something that happened exactly like that.
She got in the wrong place.
She did.
Yeah. Now, the next thing is a stand your ground. Now, how does that work and how does that protect us?
So stand your ground just relieves you of an otherwise legal duty to retreat. Meaning if you have a legal right to be where you are and you don't have a safe avenue of retreat, you can stay there. But if you have a safe avenue of retreat, you should leave because it's unreasonable to not leave. And that's where a lot of people get in trouble legally.
What has really changed things here in Montana dramatically is a law passed by the legislature several sessions ago that essentially made it that anybody can carry anywhere in this state. You don't have to have a concealed carry permit, though it is optional. And we'll talk about that and the option of a part of that. But this meant now that you can carry into a bar, you can carry into a place that sells alcohol, you can be carrying into a church. Those were places you were not allowed to carry before. What effect has this had?
So the effect that the new law had, so previous to the new law, and everyone, it changed very little in legally. Previously, in about 99% of Montana, you could still do the exact same thing. You could carry concealed without a permit. The only place you couldn't carry then was inside of incorporated city limits outside of your vehicle. Mm-hmm. And the new law changed that where you can carry concealed without a permit wherever you are. That's not a prohibited place for you to carry an unpermitted concealed weapon. That's really, in a nutshell, that's really the only thing that changed.
Okay. But what happened here is that we no longer have to have any training to use that firearm.
That's right. And that's the big crux. When this is my understanding from most people. And because they don't need a permit, they believe they don't need any training. And that could be further from the truth, especially the legal use of force. We don't miraculously know the legal use of force just because we don't need a permit.
Now, we think we know it. We know how to use a firearm because we watch them on TV. We watch these guys, bam, 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 you know, and shoot, you know, and running around corners. And it's a little different when it's you holding this firearm because it's heavier than most people think it is.
Yep, and you're on a two-way shooting range, and yep. that changes your perception. Most people have never been on a two-way shooting range with live ordnance, and your life is on the line.
Yeah. I guess those of us who have been in a combat situation understand that. It used to be here in Montana, and I believe it still is, that you can get a concealed carry permit if you have a DD-214 and can prove that you were in the military.
You can get
that training.
You can get I call it a standard permit. We have two permits. We have what I call a standard permit and an enhanced permit. An enhanced permit, you're required to take the class that's an approved class for the enhanced permit that the sheriff accepts. And then the standard permit, if you have a DD-214 and it says that you had firearms training, then you can be issued a permit if the sheriff chooses to accept it.
Yeah, of course, it says expert firearms training, so you've got the ribbon, so I guess. But the point being here is that nobody is required now to know anything about what they're doing or what their rights are, what their responsibilities are, or even how to fire that weapon. They just go buy one.
Yep. And it's scary thinking about our community. You know, what is behind that person that you're shooting? Is it 6-year-old Sally, Mary the Mother, or Brett the Breadwinner? And you missed, because bullets never miss. You missed your intended target, but it hits something. And it injures or kills one of those people that I mentioned, or it damages somebody's property, like your studio. This is a pretty nice studio, John.
Yeah.
And it damages your property. There's thousands of dollars right here in front of us. And yeah, that person's responsible for that.
We're talking about your rights and responsibilities if you decide to carry a firearm. And this is apropos, I think, because of what happened. We watched it on television in Minneapolis. A man encountered ICE agents. It turned out he was carrying a firearm, and it threw everything into a whole different discussion. And Will, let's say, for example, you encounter a police officer and you're carrying. Let's say you're in your car and you're stopped for a traffic infraction. What are your responsibilities to that officer?
John, that's a great question. When in Montana, you have no duty to notify a law enforcement officer you are carrying a handgun during a consensual or non-consensual interaction. But should you choose to share with them that you're carrying, or you're asked to step out of your rig at a traffic stop, it's advised to keep the following in mind. Keep your hands on the wheel where they can see them if you're in your rig. If you're not in your rig, keep your hands where they can see them. And then just state very plainly and calmly, "Officer, I have a permit to carry a firearm. My permit is located here. My firearm is located here. How would you like to proceed?" And then follow their direction. Do not physically resist them in any way, because if you do, you will likely be arrested and charged accordingly for resisting them. So please don't ever resist a law enforcement officer. And you're asking for physical violence against you if you do that. So in states where you do have a duty to notify during a non-consensual interaction, use the same statement that I said above. And regarding the gentleman in Minnesota, if you decided to go to an armed protest or a protest, a violent protest, please don't go. We only have a First Amendment right to peaceable assembly. Peaceable assembly. We don't put ourselves in bad situations going to violent areas carrying a firearm. That's just not a good choice. It's not unlawful, but it's not a good choice.
We've had two No Kings marches here in Kalispell and in the other cities here too in Montana. We have another one coming up the end of March. 2,500 people in Kalispell at this march. I know for a fact some of them were carrying. Not a good idea.
Not a good idea. You would never see me at anything that could possibly be violent that I intentionally went to. I may have come across it, and as soon as I recognized what's going on, I would find someplace else to be, because there is not a physically safe place to be, nor is a legally safe place to be.
And but you know, if it isn't intended to be anything other than just a peaceful march, you're marching up and down the street or up and down a walkway, would that be considered something that, you know, would I don't see that as being a violent.
I agree with you, John. I do. However, we don't know who else is there and what they're willing to do. And if you choose to go under those circumstances and it begins to go sideways and turn violent, you should probably leave.
Get the heck out of there.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Don't be there. You're mm-hmm. asking for something really bad to happen to you. And every time we leave our home, we have one goal, and that's to get home safely to our families. Nothing is more important than that. Not your grocery list, not you had to pay your bill. Get home safely to your family.
And again, if law enforcement is there, you are advised to tell them, you know, say, look, I am carrying.
That's a very personal choice. And right. I even disagree with my mentors on that.
Really?
So
seriously?
I do.
Yeah.
I have what works for me, and mm-hmm. everyone has to make an informed decision on what works for them. And really, this is not a decision just to be made haphazardly. This is yeah. truly an educated decision, and it should require a lot of thought. This isn't a 2-minute decision. It's probably a, you know, 2-day, 2-week, 2-month decision mm-hmm. that somebody needs to make.
Is it fair to say that someone who's carrying is expecting to have something bad happen to them, and that's why they're carrying?
I love that question, John. It's one of my favorite questions. A lot of times when I interact with people, they state that they have a permit because they don't need training from me. And they said, oh, I have a permit. And my apprentice and I will ask them, well, when do you carry? And they answer, when I think I need it. Now think about what the county attorney can do during a trial with that statement. You only carry a gun when you think you need it. So you are intentionally going into a bad situation to use your firearm. Instead, I encourage people to carry every day, every single day, every time you leave your house. Some people carry inside their house. They get dressed, they have their gun on. When they go to bed at night, they take their gun off and it's near them. That's the type of mentality that protects you legally, that you always have your gun no matter where you're going. You're not only taking it when you think you need it.
Oh man, that paints a whole different picture on things. I want to cover one more thing with you, and I thank you for being so generous with your time here today. And that has to do with your defense, okay? We've talked about this before, you and I have, and I want to make sure everybody understands. When you stand up in court and you say, I shot somebody for self-defense, what happens if that self-defense claim doesn't hold up?
Oh, if it doesn't hold up, in Montana, by what I've read from decisions in court, jury decisions, most people in a death, in a homicide, are sentenced to 40 to life in prison. And for most people, that's a life sentence. For you and I, John, 40 years is a life sentence for us. Yeah. Somebody recently, a couple months ago, was sentenced to 60 years. I think it was something that happened here in the Flathead. They were sentenced to 60 years. Even a 20-year-old probably wouldn't get out of prison with a 60-year sentence.
So how do we, I guess we've covered all of that before, but this whole concept here of claiming, you know, I just did it with self-defense. And you covered all the five things that would be self-defense. If one of those fails, you've just admitted to committing murder.
You listen, John, that's great. It's exactly what happens.
I have a good memory.
One fails, your whole claim of self-defense fails. And a lot of times someone may do everything correct and then they start talking and they didn't keep their evidence to themselves and they just gave the county attorney what they need to prosecute them and to find them guilty, to convince a jury.
Ability, opportunity, jeopardy.
That's imminence. Yes, sir.
All right. Gosh, I think we've kind of clarified a lot of things here today. I would imagine that anybody who wants more information should get a hold of you at Freddie Merck's.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And you do have courses, my grandson has taken a course from you. My wife is taking courses from you, and she's going to come out and take another one. So you do cover more than just using firearms. It's also personal safety.
Yes, sir.
All right. Will, thank you so much. I really do appreciate your expertise and the time you've given us this morning.
Thank you, John.